Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great.
I'm glad to hear it. You know, one of the things about this show, sometimes we talk about very serious stuff. We talk about sustainable agriculture. Sometimes we talk about assaults on small producers. Sometimes we talk about fabulous chefs, about the way they make wonderful food. Sometimes we talk with winemakers. And sometimes we just talk about the ridiculousness. And it's always been a
little... You know what's really sad?
What?
There's probably more ridiculousness out there than there is all those other things combined.
Well, what I was going to say, though, is, you know what's really sad is I think that our listeners prefer the ridiculous opening segments to the
I actually do. I think
so here you go,
fun.
Everybody. Here's what. Colleen's Cocktails blog. Okay.
It's on about.com.
It's on about.com.
Yeah.
From Colleen Graham. It's a guide to cocktails, and she writes about a law in, I believe it's West Virginia. Is it West Virginia here? Yeah. All right. Let's see. It's in Virginia. There's a place in the cocktailian United States where a bartender can spend a year in jail for serving some of the most common cocktails. A 75-year-old law in Virginia makes it illegal for an establishment to sell any mixed drinks in which beer or wine is combined with distilled spirits.
Really?
Stupid law. Okay. It was passed right after Prohibition, and it was supposedly to discourage people from drinking overly intoxicating beverages. So unless they didn't want you to put... accidentally sneak some whiskey into your beer? I don't know. But it's a dumb... the law's up for review, but it's still on the books, and aren't serving sangria.
It's time to clean up the books in Virginia. You know, there are these stupid laws. Every state has, you know, stupid, antiquated laws that have never been cleaned up. But this is an actual law, and you could actually go to jail for a year... For making sangria.
Now, I've had some sangrias where I thought the bartender should have been sent away for a little while, maybe 30 days, but that was just for a lack of quality. She also writes on her blog...
Bad wine in the sangria. Shame on you. Cuff them. Take them.
She writes, Colleen Graham here writes, this eliminates a lot of drinks, including almost every wine and champagne cocktail, the Bellini being the only legal mix. We have one of those as well. We'd be legal in Virginia as well. And many of the popular dropped shots. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm going to read that again. And many of the popular dropped shots.
I'm going to help you with something.
In New Jersey, we don't have any popular drop shots, or we shouldn't.
Well, you do in some of the college bars, but you don't really have them in, you know.
Drop shots like the Boilermaker.
Oh, sure.
The Irish Car Bomb.
You've never had an Irish Car Bomb?
Of course I've had an Irish Car Bomb.
Oh, okay. Well, come on.
No, you know what? I take that back. I've never had an Irish Car Bomb. I've seen Irish Car Bombs. And I'm not talking about Belfast.
Obviously.
Boilermaker is where you drop a shot of whiskey into a beer. An Irish Car Bomb is Irish whiskey in a Guinness?
Irish whiskey, I'm not sure that it's a Guinness, but it's Irish whiskey in a
And then here's another one that Colleen writes about that we don't know outside of Virginia up here. And, of course, the Flaming Dr. Pepper.
Which is everywhere.
What the heck is a Flaming Dr. Pepper? I really don't want to know. I think that you should also be... I think that they should repeal the law except for the Flaming Dr. Pepper.
Because I want to know.
No, you should still have to go to jail if you make a Flaming Dr. Pepper. Look, guys, I agree it shouldn't be illegal, but I don't feel so terrible that, like, that you can't make sangria... That shouldn't be discouraged. But you know what? If you're serving Irish Car Bombs or Boilermakers to people, I've been behind the bar for a long time. They call it behind the stick. I've been behind the stick for a long time. Occasionally get behind the stick once in a while. Myself, Mark, and I, since this cocktail program, when we introduce new cocktails to work for a night or two. And I know bars, man.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's drinking a Boilermaker, they're going to get drunk. Okay. Never seen it where somebody was out and said,
basically,
you know, nobody's ever said, has anybody ever said to you, you know, it's happy hour, you know, I'm just going to have one Boilermaker and then I'm going to go home.
then it's back to the traffic jam.
So I have to say, I think Boilermakers and Irish Car Bombs are irresponsible because, yes, I recognize that alcohol is a drug, but I take that back. I recognize that alcohol has effects on your body. That are like a drug, but if you're taking it, if you're trying to get drunk as quickly as possible.
There are certain drinks that are made to facilitate that. I'll never forget one. It was called a mind eraser.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, do you remember that drink? And here's basically how a mind eraser worked. It was a layered drink.
Yep.
Okay, you put Kahlua on the bottom.
Yeah.
Then you put vodka.
Yeah.
Then club soda on the top.
And you drank it through a straw.
And you
from
drank
the bottom.
It through a straw from the bottom is exactly right. And yeah. And happily these have fallen out of fashion.
I had one of those once when I was 24, and I thought that's stupid.
But basically, you got the sweet Kahlua taste
to hide the vodka,
and then the vodka was your little punch of alcohol to increase the alcohol content.
And you finished up with soda to clean
and
it
you
all
finished
up.
With a club soda, so it was just this little refreshing.
It was a way
soda feel. It was a way to get as hammered as you could as quickly as you could.
And it was also a way for people who don't really like to drink alcohol
right.
to be able to get alcohol into the system. I'm against it. You know, I mean, that's very different than having a glass of wine.
It well, is. The There's something is, collegiate though about a mind eraser.
You know,
for
and
sure.
The thing is, this is unique to American culture. I spent a lot of time in Spain. You spent a lot of time in France. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, this whole like, okay, you're illegal to drink. Okay, your 21st birthday. Now you're legal to drink.
And so you have to do 21 shots in as quickly as you possibly can.
When I was 25 years old and in Spain, if you were out at a party, and anybody could, you're 18, you could drink. 17, really, you could drink if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got drunk, people looked at you like, who's that idiot over there?
Mm-hmm.
Not like, woo, gotta have drunk. I just... We have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, and for everyone who's listening, the way to have our society have a healthy relationship with alcohol is not to ban it.
Right.
Okay, it's to...
Because then it becomes taboo. I mean, then part of the problem we have, I believe, in this country is you're not allowed to drink until you're 21, at least legally, so there's this whole taboo around it.
Well, because it becomes, I'm a badge of honor because now I'm allowed to drink.
Whereas... And I do think that there are other cultures that are too highly integrated with alcohol, where you know they are getting drunk at lunch. I mean, I've seen that too in other societies. But I think that there's such this huge taboo that people are just going off the deep end when they have the opportunity.
Well, and there's the other thing that is endemic in our culture, sort of the eating contest or the survivor sort of mm-hmm. eating the gross thing or drinking the gross thing, which is what I think Boilermakers are. They're like, are you man enough to drink that? And
well, again, I think a Boilermaker is a way to hide the flavor of a shot of whiskey in a beer.
Right. But it ruins the taste of the beer.
Yes, absolutely.
And you have to drink it very quickly, and it's not very good. And nobody really enjoys them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a badge of honor kind of thing. And I think that's really unhealthy, and it's really stupid. And what we need to ask ourselves is, look, if I'm trapped on a desert island and I need to eat ants in order to survive, yes, it is a strong and admirable person that can survive on ants. But if I'm not on a desert island and I eat ants to win money on a game show, I'm an idiot. Or I sold my soul to the devil. You know, I'm humiliating mm-hmm. myself for you. I'm eating something I would never otherwise eat in order to get a chance to win some money. I'm your trained monkey, and I'm going to jump around for you.
And remember
like
that ants are the tame things on most
yeah,
of
I
these
know,
shows.
I know.
It's, you know...
Well, but the analogy I'm drawing is to...
Noisy beetles beetles and disgusting things
but,
like that.
But the analogy I'm drawing also is to the Boilermaker or the Prairie Fire or the Mind Eraser. It's like, woohoo, look at what I can drink. And what people need to ask themselves, and to you guys who are 18, 19, 20, 21 years old and listening, is why do you want to drink that?
Mm-hmm.
Are you drinking it just to get drunk? Are you drinking it just as a drug? Or... are you drinking something that you enjoy? That's part of a civilized, ritual and culture, and enjoy, that you like to do, not that
mm-hmm.
you're challenged to do. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today we're talking with James McKinnon. He, with Elisa Smith, wrote the book Plenty, One Man, One Woman, and a Raucous Year of Eating Locally, a book detailing their adventures eating for a whole year within nothing that came from beyond a 100-mile radius of where they live.
James, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, James, I have to say, it doesn't sound so raucous to me.
have its ups and downs, didn't it?
I can envision the downs. I can envision the ups in season. But you don't live in the heart of the Anderson Valley in California. You live in a temperate climate. Let's start with the positive. What was raucous about eating locally?
Well, I think the biggest thing is it really did feel like this grand adventure. You know, when we started into it, we were as worried as anybody that it was just going to be nothing but but hardship and a lot of beet soup. And it turned out to be a real adventure in terms of building our sense of place and really immersing ourselves in the place we live. And it's exciting to track down where your food comes from.
Well, now talk to us about where you live.
We live in Vancouver in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a pretty good long summer and a cold, wet, a little bit too long winter.
Yeah, it's occasionally cold up there in Vancouver, huh?
It does get a little frosty at times.
Hey.
But that's the thing about eating locally. You know, we have a couple of restaurants here in Jersey, and we're a little warmer than you, with a little bit of a longer summer than you, I believe. But, you know, trying to run a restaurant, we go to the green markets and the farms, and they supply what's interesting in our restaurant. It's a wonderful ride from the first asparagus coming up in the spring until the last corn and tomatoes of the fall.
And apples and pears.
And then even when the
root, up the season.
And when the root vegetables are coming up around the holiday time. But, you know, they say April is the cruelest month. And from you know, December through April, you know, and everybody's thinking, spring. And people come to the restaurant thinking, oh, it's spring. What do you have? I'm like,
flowers and grass.
Right now,
that's what we got mostly.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to explain to people. Yes, it's spring and it's warm outside and everything's just started growing. Come back in 2 months.
Those flowers turn into fruit, you know.
Yeah, exactly, but it's going to take a while. What we've done, and I see what you did in your book as well, is we've actually started putting up a lot of our own fruit in the summer before. We put up, 8,000 pounds of tomatoes?
We did indeed.
So that we can continue to eat locally through the year. Is that the only way to eat locally through the year, is to put stuff by, as they used to say, in the summertime?
Yeah, I mean, I think putting stuff by in the harvest season, right from late summer through to fall, is definitely the best way to get through the winter, unless in some places, as local eating is becoming more popular, it's becoming easier to actually buy local canned goods in some places, and that's a real treat for people who can't find the time to, or the interest to put up a whole winter's worth of food. And, of course, we didn't have that advantage when we first started the 100-mile diet. And the one thing people ask, they say, well, you know, if you were going to do one thing different, what would it be? Well, we wouldn't start on the first day of spring.
Right.
Because we had that urban idea that you were just talking about, that on the first day of spring, the vegetables just shoot out of the ground and they're ready to put in the fry pan.
Nothing, pow, a tomato.
Yeah, and of course, it's not like that at all. So we had this, and we had a particularly long, cold, wet spring that year. And for a little while, we really were going pretty much on the very last root vegetables from the last season and really wondering if it was even going to be possible.
Yeah, it can be a real struggle. But if you're going to eat locally, I think one of the things that has to come into it that most Americans just simply don't do with their food, and that's plan.
Yeah.
You have to have a plan to be able to eat locally.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that it gets easier and easier. By the end of the year, by the following spring, it really wasn't difficult at all. We'd found good sources for food. We'd put away food in the previous fall and summer, and really at that point it just becomes nothing but a pleasure.
Well, it's sort of like learning to speak a language. You know, you can take your class and go to class 3 days a week and study to try and learn to speak a language, and it seems quite difficult. Move to the other country, however, and if you know, and immerse yourself in it, and it becomes second nature quickly.
But truly, you know, I think that's a great analogy, because the first 3 or 4 weeks that you're in that other country, you go to bed with a headache every night.
Right. But then you sort of walk it and breathe it. Are you still eating within 100 miles or relatively locally? How's that? What's the lasting impact doing this for years had on your diet and your life?
Yeah, it utterly and permanently, I think, changed the way we eat. We don't hold to an absolutely strict 100-mile radius at this point anymore, but we're eating about 90% locally, maybe even higher than that. And we do it because we want to. I mean, the very last meal of our official year on the 100-mile diet, we woke up the next day and said, well, you know, what are we going to go eat today, and what do you feel like having for breakfast? And we just felt like having local food again, you know, because it was it's just such a great way to eat. I mean, everything is so fresh. The food quality that we were getting over that year was better than anything we'd ever eaten before. And there's a special pleasure to eating food when you know the story of that food. I think that really became the critical thing for us above all the other benefits of eating locally.
James, when we come back, I want you to talk to our listeners about the foods you missed the most, though, because all of us have those foods that we would miss if we didn't have them for a year.
If I wanted to eat locally, I'd have to move to Belgium so I could have Belgian beer all the time.
and chocolate. There you go. You're covered.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment talking more with James McKinnon about plenty, one man, one woman, and a raucous year of eating locally. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis with the Restaurant Guys talking with James McKinnon about his book, Plenty, One Man, One Woman, and a Raucous Year of Eating Locally, where for a whole year he ate nothing that came from more than 100 miles away.
James, there are foods that you talked about that you wanted to eat the next day when you were done, you wanted to eat locally. But there had to be certain foods that you craved, that you missed, that you can't get locally.
Yeah, I mean, the really surprising one for us was wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked into this thinking, well, you know, wheat's in almost everything. It's such a vital part of the daily diet. And somehow we assumed that some of that was going to turn up locally somewhere. And that didn't turn out to be the case at all. We ended up spending 7 months of the diet without any wheat or wheat products. And you think of the list of those, everything from bread to pasta to crackers. That was a long run without those wheat products. And that was also ended up turning out to be a really interesting story, because we discovered that if we'd been looking for wheat 80 years ago in our area, it wouldn't have been difficult to find at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just this centralization and industrialization of the food system that's kind of pushed wheat off of a lot of the places it used to be grown at a local level and concentrated it all in certain places and almost always with a single variety.
And one of the things you can be sure of, if it happened to wheat, it happened to other things as well.
Well, absolutely. And what's, you know, one of the really interesting things that's come out of it is that as local eating has really blossomed, especially in this area around Vancouver, people are growing wheat again. So a couple of years ago when we were doing the diet, we couldn't find it for 7 months till we found one rogue farmer who was growing a patch. And this year, we're swimming in wheat. There's all kinds of local growers who have put some in the ground over the last year and offered us up a bag, and all of a sudden we've got more wheat than we know what to do with.
Well, they know you're in the market.
That's absolutely right.
Something mildly disturbing about the way that you put that, the swimming in wheat thing. I haven't quite come to terms with that. But we'll come back after the news and talk more with James McKinnon about eating locally, about this wonderful book that he's written about the whole experience. It's a novel as well as a nonfiction book. Maybe can give you some ideas about how you can change the way that you eat in a pleasurable and not a difficult way. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with James McKinnon, who with Elisa Smith wrote Plenty, One Man, One Woman in a Raucous Year of Eating Locally. Now, for a year, you ate, as a couple, completely nothing that came from more than 100 miles away. Now, one of the things that people talk about who you know, shop at Whole Foods or who have criticism for Whole Foods or Wegmans is this chain around here where we do try to source locally and we just do try to source good food, is that it can be expensive, that sometimes the local food is more expensive than the local tomato, even in season, can be more expensive than the tomato from Guatemala. Did you find that you saved more money or spent more money in the long run trying to hew the line of 100 miles?
Actually, in the long run, we found that we were spending about the same amount of money, but you spend your money very differently. So in our first couple of meals, when we were just at the mercy of the local, you know, whatever local foods were available in the shops, we were paying a lot more than we anticipated, and actually wondered if we were even going to be able to continue the year. But over time, especially as we got to know the growers and the producers of our food, and buy directly from them with no middleman at all, we actually found that in many cases the price of the food was much lower, especially if you were comparing it to food of the same quality, you know, organically grown, really fresh, really high quality food. But we also found that, you know, for example, we'd spend a lot of money in late summer and early fall when everything was available, and we'd be buying it up in bulk and putting it away for the winter. And then through the winter, we'd sometimes go 2 weeks without spending a dime on food because we'd just be reaching into our stores of canned foods and frozen and dried foods.
You know, for us we have this exact same experience because we do have a root cellar in the restaurant, so we're putting up pears and strawberries and cherries and all those things
sugar plums as they
come in. And for us, it's kind of unusual because it's a period of time where we have less business, where the restaurant is quieter because a lot of people go vacation to other places in the state or in the country or other countries, and it's a time where we're actually spending more money on food than we would otherwise, just because we're trying to get all these things at the height of the season. And, you know, for us it works out because we are able to use those foods all throughout the rest of the year.
Well, and we use them mostly now. And as you said, as we're starting now, we see our food costs go down because we're going into we see our expenditures on food go down because we're going into our larder. And there's something really, you know, you mentioned before the break about you're able more and more to get locally put up food. But be careful when you're not putting up food yourself or putting by food yourself, because what you want to be careful of is that someone's not taking this local food and stabilizing it with some chemicals that you maybe don't want to use to stabilize a food. And the other thing you want to do is be careful that you're doing it right so you don't wind up with botulism.
That's right. Yeah, you do have to be careful. But one of the great things about eating locally and actually getting out, I mean, when we're buying canned foods, again, we're buying them from the people who did the canning, and we have access to all that information that we want. And that was one of the real blessings with eating locally, was the closer you come to the producer, the more information there is available to you about how that food was produced, what went into it, what went into the ground. And then you can make the kind of choices that I think all people really want to make about what's going into their food and where it's coming from. And that was one of the real pleasures.
Well, now, one of the things that you talked about was the relationship with salt. Talk to us about how you dealt with salt through the year.
Yeah, salt ended up being our one cheater food for most of the year. I mean, we're here on the ocean, and we can smell the salt in the air every morning, but nobody actually produces any here. So we ended up having to use this sea salt. The closest we could find was from Oregon. And then at the end of the year, we thought, we have to get this to 100%, absolute 100%, and we just went out to the cleanest ocean water we could find within 100 miles, and we made salt.
And you just boiled it down and made the salt?
Yeah, we actually just sat there, and we were already starting to write up some of our experiences, and we just had a big pot on, slowly boiling itself down. And the most amazing thing was the first thing we got was fleur de sel.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, why don't you explain to people what Florida Cell is? That's the most valuable salt around. But
that's
tell,
right.
Tell
it's just this very, very fine, it crystallizes in sheets on the top of the water and makes these very, very fine flakes of salt. And I could never afford to put it on my food normally, but we had more of it than we could possibly use in the first round as it formed Fleur de Sel. And then after that, we ended up with about a year's worth of salt from our one little salt making
mission. How much water did it take to make how much salt?
Well, that was one great big pot. I'm not actually sure exactly
a large lobster pot, stock pot kind of thing?
That's right, a large stock pot, like a large canning pot. And that that boiled down to about a pound of salt, about as much as we would use over a year,
and
pound or two of salt.
And Fleur de Sel, just so everyone's aware of exactly what it is that we're talking about, when people harvest salt, and if you're going to use larger, if you're going to try and make more salt than you can make on your stove, the way it's done is it's hand harvested by letting salt seawater come into salt marshes, or not salt marshes, but salt beds, and then as the water evaporates away, you get basically they're crystal clear sheets of solid salt that form on the top that then have to be broken up to let the water continue to evaporate. But these crystal clear sheets of very thin salt are very crunchy. They're not very saline, and they taste of the sea.
There's a wonderful salt out there called Malden salt, which has that great flaky quality that James was talking about just a minute ago. But it is very expensive.
Yeah, and it was completely unexpected for us. We just walked in, and there were, by this time we'd sort of taken small volumes of concentrated salt and put it into shallow pans, and the surface of the pans just hardened into this shell of flakes, and we just skimmed that off with a wooden spatula and popped it straight onto our breakfast that morning.
And how much did you pay for the seawater?
We paid whatever it took to feed me to paddle out into the water.
Now here's a question that I am very curious. Now I don't know the nature of, without getting too personal, the nature of your relationship, but did this affect your relationship as a couple at all? Did this how did you come together or grow apart, or were there any fights or?
Well, you know what we found is that we didn't even realize it at the time, but we were revolutionizing something that's very central to everyday life. And at first we didn't understand just how powerful that was going to be. We underestimated how big a change it was going to be, and change is always a little bit stressful. So for us initially, there was a little bit of a wrestling match about how far we were going to go with this and how much work we were going to put into it. But over time it became this very deep shared experience, you know, where we were getting to know where our food was coming from together. We were doing more food preparation and cooking and canning together, and those things became very powerful in terms of drawing us together.
You know, I'm going to say that what you did wasn't a revolution, though. I'm going to say it was a counter-revolution, because what happened in the 50s and 60s changed what had been happening in the world for the hundreds of years before that. We all ate the foods that were from within 100 miles of us. That's what everybody did forever, and then all of a sudden we stopped doing that, and I think to our detriment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we often say that we've got the oldest new idea in the world in this book. And really, in a sense, local eating is just, it skipped a generation, maybe a generation and a half. And so people of my generation are, you know, we're starting to drift back to this, and the people we need to go to get the information we need to eat this way are typically our grandparents.
Well, or your book, and I think that's one of the great things about your book is talking about how to deal with this in a large way. And you know, one of the other things that your book points out is that, and in the locavore movement, very often we see one of the things that's a danger, and we better get back to it soon, is that the infrastructure that lasted for the first several hundred years of this country have started to fall away and atrophy. Like you said, you couldn't get wheat around Vancouver, because you could the whole time people have been living in Vancouver, but from the 70s to the 90s it fell away, and due to people's interest, and like you out there listening, due to your interest, that's how we keep these local food producers alive. But once that infrastructure falls away, it's very hard to rebuild.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, eating the 100-mile diet changed the way we look at everything, and one of the things that it really changed was how we look at cities and how cities are building out onto some of the best agricultural land in their regions. And looking at that with the eyes of a locavore, it looks absolutely insane. And some of the most exciting things that have happened have been things like a small community north of Vancouver where about 250 people tried a 5-week local eating experiment, and all of a sudden they were realizing, hey, we have the power with the way we spend our food dollars to really shape the way our community works and to make opportunities for the farmers who are there, make new opportunities for people who might want to farm. And you could see people just waking up to their own power, realizing that when they don't spend their dollars down at the supermarket, their dollars stay in the community and get put to work.
You know, it's funny. I read about that in the newspaper, and those 250 people, I understand they only resorted to cannibalism at the very end, but 249 of those folks, and technically it was local. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more with J.B. McKinnon about his book, Plenty, One Man, One Woman, and a Raucous Year of Eating Locally. 1450 WCTC, the time is 11:47.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with James McKinnon about his book Plenty and about his year of eating locally. Now you learned to put up food. Is this the first time that you put food up or put food by for consumption later in the year, or is this something you had done sort of casually prior to your experiment?
The two of us have done a little bit. I mean a very little bit of jam making, and but this was really the first year that we did it at any kind of scale like this. Certainly, first time we did anything like make pickles or make sauerkraut.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to interject to the people listening out there. We have some of these Indyke Farms preserved tomatoes, and we're not just using them in the tomato sauce for Kathleen Lombardi. We're using them in things like, we have this great preserved tomato and fennel ravioli, which is just, it's spectacular, and it's spectacular because the tomatoes were picked when they were absolutely perfect, and we got to preserve them when they're absolutely perfect, and they don't come from Peru, and they don't come from California.
And they don't come from Italy.
They come from our backyard, and that's what makes them better.
You know, there's an emotional thing that I find when I put up stuff at home, and I haven't done that in years, but a good friend of ours, we started putting up fruits. A friend of ours puts up fruits in alcohol and preserves them that way, and that's sort of a special occasion dessert thing. It's really hard to make an entree out of your Sambuca pears, but he gives them away at Christmas time, and I have to say it's one of the gifts that I look most mm-hmm. forward to getting. When you put up food, I find that when somebody gives me something that they've put up, I think that has a tremendous amount more meaning and tastes better.
And the Armagnac apples are just unbelievable.
And when I eat something that I've put up or that we've put up locally, there's a feeling of pride and connectedness that I think makes maybe some of the best food in the world. Do you experience that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that people do trade their foods is because they have a lot of pride in the stuff they put together, and they're also beautiful. I mean, when you've got all of these jars full of apricots and peaches and tomatoes and pickles, I mean, we end up putting a few of them out all the time just to decorate the house.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. And there are so many ways to put stuff up. I mean, there's you talked about sauerkraut. There's a great book out on the art of fermenting food, you know, partially fermenting food to preserve it. There's regular putting stuff by, which is, you know, heating it and basically pasteurizing it by boiling a mason jar. And then there's preserving things in alcohol and sugar. And I find them to be tremendous.
Well, the great thing is, I mean, it's really not rocket science. I mean, I was very cautious about that part of it because I just thought, well, this is going to be the worst part of the year, learning how to do this complicated food preservation thing, and it turns out that it's really pretty simple.
Yeah, if you know how to boil water, you can pretty much do it.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And you put away beautiful food, as you're saying. I mean, we've got the same feeling here that when I make a pasta sauce now, I don't have to throw 500 ingredients into it to make it taste good. I just start with those canned tomatoes, and I don't have to do too much more from there.
Yeah,
but well, you do say pasta.
Pasta.
Oh, that's very good. That's very
well
good.
Done.
All right, now I'm afraid we have to leave it in just a moment or two, but is there any one thing in the last minute that you'd like to share with our listeners? What's the largest lesson you learned from your year's experience and the reaction to your book since you've written it?
Well, really, I think the thing I'd want to leave people with is do it. Try it. You know, I think when people try it, they find that they love it. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be as simple as putting together, starting by putting a meal together with friends, splitting up the labor, sending people out to find what's out there in the local landscape and bring it together into one meal, cook it together, and I think that'll be the launching pad for that whole group to go out and do a lot more local eating.
James, it sounds like you and we could get together and have a great time at dinner.
I think we should.
We'll bring the wine. If you're ever in Jersey, you have to stop by and have a bite.
Promise.
Will do.
All right, the book is Plenty, One Man, One Woman, and a Raucous Year of Eating Locally. Find out more about it on our website, and you might even want to pick it up and give it a try yourself. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi. Great, great book.
Yeah.
Interesting guy.
You know, along the lines of, you know, this great feel-good show that we just did, and I realize not all our shows are feel-good shows, but this is a great feel-good show, and a way that you can do things differently and look at things differently. And I want to make a suggestion to people out there. You can go to your local farmer's market and buy a case of peaches basically for the same price as buying, you know, enough, you know, buying 10 or 12 peaches out of season at your supermarket.
Yeah.
Okay, in season, go to a farmer's market and buy a case of peaches. Usually they give you a great deal if you buy a whole case of peaches. And my recommendation is, it's not that much more work when you're making a peach cobbler for yourself. Make 4 or 5 of them. It really isn't that much more work. And give them out to your neighbors. And that homemade, home-cooked, fresh in the season food, I guarantee you make all your neighbors smile. It'll be something that will connect you for a very, very long time.
Mark, did you just find out that a couple of your neighbors listen to the show? Is that what happened?
Well, you know, we talked all for the whole show about this feel good and you know, being able to do that with your neighbors. And I think it's a great thing. But New Jersey is losing something right now that it doesn't need to lose.
Okay, let me tell you something. Look, you know the whole, Mark and I say, oh, you know, whatever you want to eat is fine. If you invite me over to your house, I'm not, I cook for me.
Right.
People are nervous about cooking for us if they have us over. That's
make
foolish.
Me a homemade cobbler. You don't have to be nervous.
But you know what I really don't like? I've been to a couple of family events where I've said, okay, now you two bring desserts, or there's a bake sale even, and someone, and people show up with Entenmann's.
Oh, golly.
Pies.
Yeah, for sure it happens.
It's not a buy at the market sale. Why would I buy a piece of Entenmann's pie?
Right, make me brownies.
Okay, if you want me to give your Girl Scout $5, you better make me a pie, make me brownies, something. And certainly if someone invites you over to their house, to bring a cake from a great bakery. Mm-hmm. Okay. Don't bring an Entenmann's cake.
Right.
Just bring $7. They'll buy their own cake.
Do you know that something's happened in New Jersey? It has become illegal for these local farm stands to sell you pies that aren't made in some large commissary. It's really something very, very sad.
Ridiculous rules.
You know, one of the things that James was talking about was you can, you know, you could go and get these things from these farmers in some places here in New Jersey.
In Jersey.
You can't do that anymore, and it's a shame.
Crazy. All right, I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. Got to go. The news is coming up next. We'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.